This is CliffCentral.com.
Excuse us, we're just singing along to that beautiful song in sign language.
Well done for the sign language. You remember that? Oh, God, that was beautiful. And then the head movement, and then the jam, and then, oh, man, viral video is just rock and roll. I love that. Subtimus 4, yes. Good morning. Sanmunan Nonke, that is how we start the show today. It is, frankly speaking, 1 hour. Rory, we are speaking privacy today, but yes, let's talk about our privates.
How private are your privates?
How private are your privates? When you send me that photo of yourself, that naked photo, that selfie.
Don't tell people what we do with men.
Thank God for encryption on WhatsApp, eh? Because now we don't have to worry about that. But we did. We did have to worry about that quite a lot, didn't we?
No. Maybe you. Me, I don't play that game.
Don't lie. I saw those pictures of you. They were sexy.
No.
I mean, you saw what happened the other day with that Panama leaks.
Yeah, just this week, actually, a big leak. How many documents again?
11.2 million documents.
11.2 million documents of the financial affairs of a whole host of people. And not to be outdone, of course.
Of course.
Our very own president features there through his nephew, Kulubuse Zuma.
We couldn't be outdone by that. We wanted
that. No, of course. Our president is an overachiever when it comes to that sort of thing. and of course, before that, you had the FBI versus Apple case that was going on, where the FBI essentially took Apple to court to force them to unlock a phone that, that they were struggling to unlock in a terrorism investigation, I think it was. And then before that, you've got Edward Snowden with it, and then you've got WikiLeaks, right?
And also celebrity porn pictures. Let's not forget those.
Yeah, they bring that upon themselves. But if you're in the US, it's a big deal. Privacy is a huge deal, especially in the US. I don't know if it's such a huge deal for South Africans, and that's what we're going to investigate. Do South Africans really care about privacy? In the United States, it is a big deal. I mean, this whole thing with the Apple, my first instinct to that case was, hey, they're trying to deal with terrorism. How do you expect them to deal with terrorism if they can't access these phones and so on? But then on the other hand is, so if they can do that for terrorism, what else can they do? And how safe are you ultimately? And that's the premise for the show today.
Absolutely. I think we're going to be talking about private security as well as state security. We're going to speak to someone at the Right to Know campaign about state surveillance. How much surveillance should the state have over you? And how much, how many eyes should we have on the state? You know that the Information Act has been trying to be passed for a couple of years now. It has been blocked so far. But how long will that last, given the fact that the dominoes are starting to fall around our president, Jacob Zuma? I found this interesting thing on Reddit. Just yesterday, you've seen all this Panama stuff, and it can be quite confusing with regards to what actually is going on with the company Mossack Fonseca, very hard to pronounce. And I found a really cool thing on Reddit talking about this whole thing being explained by a five-year-old. So here is exactly what this debacle of 11.2 million documents actually means. When you get a quarter, you put it in a piggy bank. The piggy bank is on a shelf in your closet. Your mom knows this, and she checks on it every once in a while. So she knows when you put more money in or you spend it. Now, one day you might decide, I don't want my mommy to look at my money. So you go over to Johnny's house with an extra piggy bank that you're going to keep in his room. You write your name on it and put it in his closet. Johnny's mom is always very busy, so she never has time to check on his piggy bank. So you can keep yours there, and it will stay a secret. Now, all the kids in the neighborhood think this is a good idea as well. And everyone goes to Johnny's house with extra piggy banks. And now Johnny's closet is full of piggy banks from everyone in the neighborhood. One day, Johnny's mom comes home and sees all the piggy banks. She gets very mad and calls everyone's parents to let them know. Now, not everyone did this for a bad reason. Eric's older brother always steals from his piggy bank, so he just wanted to get a better hiding spot. Timmy wanted to save up to buy his mom a birthday present without her knowing, and Sammy just did it because he thought it was fun. but many kids did it for a bad reason, Zuma. His name is Jacob in this example. Jacob was stealing people's lunch money and didn't want his parents to figure it out. Michael was stealing money from his mom's purse. Fat Bobby's parents put him on a diet and didn't want them to figure out when he was buying candy. Now in real life, many very important people were just caught hiding their piggy banks at Johnny's house in Panama. But today, their moms all found out. Pretty soon, we'll know more about which of these important people were doing it for a bad reason and which were doing it for good reasons. But almost everyone is in trouble regardless, because it's against the rules to keep secrets no matter what.
And this is a big deal because the president of Iceland had to resign.
Just resigned
because of... And isn't it interesting, as a sidebar, what it takes to remove a president in other countries? Like, what must JZ do? In our country, what is going to need to happen in this country to make sure that we remove this man? It's fascinating. This guy, he had a piggy bank in Panama, and people went into the streets and he resigned immediately.
Yeah, that's called accountability. We have none of that here. So Zuma can do exactly what the hell he wants.
Or the lack of balls.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So we're talking privacy. How private are your privates? Hit us up on WeChat if you want any questions to our guest Right to Know. And as well as a security expert, we're speaking to him in studio. His name is Seaton Hayes. We'll be chatting to him this morning and finding out exactly how private your privates are. You can also tweet us at Yebo_LEVY or at Rory Shabalala. Those are the tweeting details on Twitter. And we want to find out exactly how safe you are and if this is a real problem. I mean, Rory, do you care? I mean, I've seen you in coffee shops and you always bring out your own dongle, even if there's free Wi-Fi. Why are you doing that?
No, don't tell people I bring out my dongle.
Don't do that.
I think it's a big deal, right? We carry a lot of personal information on our machines and so on, and so you don't want that hacked. So you have to take whatever precautions you can to make sure that you're safeguarded. So the more, in my mind, you remain off public networks, the better. On the other hand, you are the type of guy that says, if you're gonna hack me, who cares?
Yeah, I don't have much to hide. That's the problem. I wish I did.
Who said
maybe.
I've got a lot to hide? I don't have a lot to hide.
I just don't want to hide.
My privates need to remain private.
Let's bring Seaton Hayes into the conversation. Seaton, good morning to you. I'm dubbing you as a security expert. What would you call yourself?
Security, definitely been in the security industry for about 14 years, so I know a little bit about it.
You need to come a little closer to the mic. Closer, I know, like, they can't hack you into the microphone. It's okay. So you would call yourself a security expert. Give us a little bit of background as to where this fascination of, I suppose, hacking and then securing people came from.
You know, I've always been interested in IT. You know, I broke my first computer when I was in primary school and
By broke, you mean you hacked
No,
it.
Actually broke it. Oh. Like, took it apart, put it back together. hacked my first few computers when I was in high school, hacked the school computers. You know, I got in a bit of trouble for that. And always had a fascination with it. And how security works, how, you know, people apply policies, how they think something's secure where it's actually not secure at all. And I just had a fascination through it. So that progressed through my career. I went in, studied data metrics at Varsity, went through into IT positions, got a job at a financial institution in the security division, you know, headed up the project team, headed up the penetration testing, which is a hacking team essentially doing...
Whoa, slow down. You mean our financial institutions have hacking teams called penetration teams?
do,
I don't know what's worse do. About that statement. I'm not sure. So what does a penetration team do?
Essentially, we try and hack the systems that are within the financial institutions as well as our subordinate companies, etc., and look for vulnerabilities so that we can find those vulnerabilities and patch them before external hackers can. And because we have an internal knowledge of the systems that we're trying to penetrate, we usually find more flaws than the external guys would. So, you know, a lot of big companies use the services of penetration testers.
I'm fascinated by this. Like, just give me a sense, in South Africa, how many people are trying to hack? I mean...
Well, you know, it's a bit smaller than the international circuit. It's all about cost, actually, because, you know, an external hacker, they need to look at their intended target, and they need to say, you know, how much reward am I going to get by hacking this target? And they need to, because it takes them time. It takes them a lot of time to get into that target, and it takes them a lot of, you know, prep work and sometimes applications that they need to spend on cost and virtual servers, etc. So it's all about a cost and reward system. So when they want to get into a system, they need to be able to have enough cost and enough incentive to get in there. Hack, you know, if you have, if you run a multiple firewalls across this organization, you will see hacking attempts all the time from external countries, internal countries, mostly from external countries. And they're just running brute force, which is just trying every kind of password against your systems, etc. The very basic attacks. The advanced attacks, we haven't seen many of them yet in this country. But,
what is an advanced attack? Okay, what does that mean?
So, you know,
this guy's scaring me, Rory.
Yeah, you've got stuff that people can take out of the
bank. I know.
Me.
White Monopoly Capital.
Yeah, white okay. Monopoly. Okay. Me, you hack, you don't hack is the same for me.
That balance in the bank account is the same. All right. What is an advanced attack, Sutton?
Well, let's start with the basic attack. A basic attack is essentially like a phishing attack, where multiple mails are sent to multiple clients asking for username and passwords for banking environments or for Facebook or for Twitter passwords. Mm. And they use that information to hack your accounts, essentially. Where a more advanced attack is actually targeting specific companies, targeting specific individuals in that company, like a spear phishing attack. A spear phishing attack is a targeted phishing attack against an individual that you have information about. So, for example, like you, Andrew.
Uh-oh.
If I wanted to get into your Facebook profile, you know, right. I could try hack Facebook, but that's going to be a really, really hard hack because they've put a lot of security controls in.
Mm.
So what I would do to hack you, for example, is I would need to know a little bit about you. So I do some information research. I'd see, oh, Andrew really likes surfing, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you do actually like surfing. Mm-hmm. So I would target a specific email or some kind of alert to you, offering you a website or a promotion on a surfing application. Right. And I'd ask you to log into it. Essentially, I'd ask you to create an account, maybe with your email address and password. Now, just because the password's blanked out on the screen doesn't mean I don't have access to it because I control that website.
Mm-hmm.
So usually, people use the same email address and password for that site as they do for their Facebook
everything.
Or Twitter.
Absolutely.
Hopefully
everything.
Not your banking account.
Yeah, yeah. Else. Everything.
That everything right. else. So I would use that information to log onto your Facebook, and I could obtain additional information, like, for example, your address and all that kind of stuff. Because I'm trying to get your ID number and all that type of stuff so that I can, you know, pretend to be you on the call center or something like that, so I can get additional information. So I'd use Facebook and I'd log into Twitter and I'd try and pull as much information as I can to be able to bypass any security controls later on in time, which is quite scary.
Seaton, is it all driven by your login details? Is that the way that generally most of us get hacked? It's just through typical login details and giving those away.
In this country, it's phishing. Mm. Phishing usually gets the most attacks, most viability, because users in this country aren't as security aware as other countries. So the phishing attacks are still very, very prevalent in this country, and they still work. So so until such time as you know, the population is... Because you are the ones that are in charge of your username and password and your credentials.
Mm.
It's not anyone else. And if you compromise those or you give those away on a phishing site, then unfortunately, you know, you're the one who's responsible for it.
Let's talk about financial institutions. We hear constantly, increasingly actually, around how people go into the bank, that teller maybe logs into your profile and realizes how much you've got. And then the next thing, you're followed home and bad things happen to you. How secure are we from the institutions themselves? Because we just take it for granted that I can trust this institution. But to what extent are we safe from the people that work in these institutions?
Well, the bank, I can't speak for all banks, but the ones that I've worked at, they do take quite a lot of precautions with regards to confidential information. So, you know, only certain people have access to that. But saying that, a lot of employees need access to that information because, you know, they need to do their job. They need to open accounts. They need to transfer money. So they need access to your information to transfer it. And you're essentially giving that access to them. And you can't perform the job function without that access. And if you have one or two bad individuals which can pull that information, you know, it's very, very hard for any corporate institution to make any controls around that. You know, you can vet them, you can do background checks, you know, but you actually have, I mean, there's just too many employees to do to be able to fully secure that environment.
And then you spoke earlier around all of the hacks that are happening. What's the level of hacking that's happening? Are we seeing like attempts like one a day, or are we seeing hundreds and thousands of attempts to hack?
A lot of them are automated. So you have bots and bot networks. Essentially, a lot of computers that are trying to break into computers all the time. They use something like RDP brute, where they're doing RDP, remote desktop attacks, to try and take over servers. And
just explain that to us for layman.
So most companies have IT support offsite. So, well, I was going to say a lot of smaller, medium businesses have a lot of IT support offsite. So they allow access into their network to be able to control those servers. And those that is specific is called RDP, remote desktop. So remote desktop protocol. And there's a lot of RDP brute forcing going on. So essentially, if you've got a username and password on your server, which is very weak, that RDP brute force will find it. And they'll be able to log onto your server and they'll be able to do all kinds of things. Use your server as a platform to launch additional attacks, alternatively try and pull information off, or some of the latest ones we've seen is, like, I don't know if you know what the Locky virus is. Locky virus is the virus that came by email, popped on your machine, and they would encrypt all your files.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so and then you'd have to pay Bitcoins
ransom.
To get it.
Oh, wow, really? Bitcoins?
Yeah,
clever.
Yeah. So I think the latest one, it's like one or two Bitcoins. So what's that, 12,000, 13,000 Rand?
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's quite a
two high. Bitcoins is 13,000 Rand.
I think
Rand.
So. You'd have to check that. You'd
oh,
have
my
to check
God. That. If you thought that you were tuned into Tech Central, you are not. You're actually tuned into Frankly Speaking. Now, let's ask the real important question, Seton. How do I get an American Netflix account?
Well, I believe that Unotelly is up and running again.
Yes, Unotelly. Awesome. Okay, so our information is it feels like quite easily accessible. Am I right? Am I wrong? Like, so I mean, if you really wanted to hack in and find steal my identity, how long do you think that would take you as an individual who worked for a financial institution, who was a professional at this, like, give me a sense of what that's going to...
I think for you it would be a little bit easier, Andrew, and the reason is that there's two reasons. One is you've got a public profile,
right?
So a lot of your information is freely accessible. The second thing is I know you personally, so
that's a real problem.
So I know a lot of information about you. So for you specifically, it would take me much less time than it would for Rory, for example. But you know,
all right. What are you doing right now? You think just because you're black, you can't be found online because there's so many of you? No, Rory. Okay, so that's a little scary. We've been seeing all this right to know. We're going to get them on the line now with state surveillance. Talk to me a little bit about your thoughts about this, like, information and government right now. How much spying, viewing are they doing of you and me, or maybe someone who's politically, you know, in the political landscape?
Well, we've seen a bit with Jacob Zuma spy tapes, etc., like that. With the, I think there was NI involvement. You guys would probably know better than I would in that specific sense. But, you know, I think the NI in this country would do. I think the NI in this country would do quite a bit of surveillance. I don't know what the capabilities are. As I said, I haven't.
What do you think? I mean, are they listening to calls? Is that the hacking into your phone and then listening to your calls?
I think it would be very hard for them to listen because of the infrastructures that we have. We have, you know, SIP based infrastructures now. Calls are going all over the place. There's no central location for these calls. I mean, it's internet-based calls, so it would be a really tough one for them. You know, a lot of the stuff is encrypted, they're specific. So yeah, I mean, in the old days where Telkom was the only service provider, sure, I think they would have had a feed into there. But you know, it's also about volume. There's so much volume of calls. You know, you'd need some kind of automated system to be able to listen in, you know, a lot like the states do, where you listen in for keywords and stuff in those conversations. I mean, you take a look at, for example, this Panama thing. That's 2.6 terabytes of information. That is so much information that they had to use automated systems and indexing and all kinds of stuff to be able to pull the information out. It's just such a lot of data. And I think listening in it really comes down to what systems you have to listen in onto those calls. So you need to look for keywords because you can't listen to every call. I mean, it's practically impossible. So I think the surveillance guys, you know, they're at a bit of disadvantage now because of the disbursement of telephone communication. Email's exactly the same. It disperses all over the place, so there's no central location where you can tie in and listen to all that information, get all that information. Yeah.
So, Seaton, it sounds like if we are to answer the question that the show is asking today, how private are your privates? They're not very private. You're at high risk, and yeah. So then how does one then live in a world like that? And what are the consequences of not caring? I mean, most of us really don't care, and our lives keep going just fine. A guy like you, how do you make sure that your private are private?
I was about to ask that. That's like let's ask the hacker what he does to keep himself. Like, he doesn't have any computers or anything
Yeah, and I've got quite a few. You see, from my type of stuff, all my security documents, all my documents that are really, really important to me and really secure,
mm-hmm.
I store off-site in encrypted storage. It's always been that way, and I've always stored it. All the stuff that I don't really mind, my personal documents, stuff like that. When I say personal documents, not my ID number, my copies of the ID, that will all go into personal storage. But all of that other stuff that I don't mind if anyone reads, you know, that I'll just treat like normal. The stuff I don't mind putting on Facebook in a public profile, for example, that'll just be on my computer. But my secured stuff will be in secured storage. So
what does that mean?
Okay, yeah, I feel like such a noob. Hey, I know nothing about this.
So, you know, you gotta look. There's two ways about this. There's availability and then there's confidentiality. So, for example, if your computer crashes, you want all your data back, right?
Right.
So, what's the logical choice? Oh, we pop it on cloud storage. Great. Mm-hmm. So, we use a Dropbox or any of that something. Dropbox does encrypt all the stuff, but can they read that data? Probably. Mm. They could probably at a push read that data. So, how secure is it? We actually don't know because we don't know. We don't know how secure it is because we don't have access to all of their stuff. So, when I say secured storage, I'm saying storage that I control. So storage that, for me as an IT professional, I've created my own secure storage.
So it's what, an external hard drive?
It's external on my network that's accessible by me through encrypted channels. Yeah. So I have an OpenVPN tunnel, encrypted tunnel, where I access my documents off a NAS, a network area storage device.
Okay, I can't even start knowing what a NAS is. So maybe for a guy like me, what do I buy? Because... what is it that I buy to protect myself?
The best thing you
a
can buy.
A filing cabinet.
Print it and stick it in there, lock it up.
And then delete, dude. Delete as much as you can.
The best thing you can buy, and it's such a cliche, but the best thing you can buy is knowledge. You need to understand what the risks are. And it is so important to understand that when you put the documents on there, you're not going on public networks. Great. Really, really good. Really good advice. Public networks are a huge problem. Because you don't know how they've been set up. That, you know, if they've been set up to isolate each user from each other or any of that kind of stuff. And a hacker can sit on that network and sniff the data.
So just give us, because a lot of us do walk into coffee shops. And just link up to the Wi-Fi. Tell us what's the risk there and what happens.
Okay, so the risk is most people will plug in and the first thing they'll do is open up Gmail or they'll open up their Outlook or they'll connect to a server. Now, if I'm sitting on that network and I have a sniffer going and I've, I don't want to go too technical, I've made it so that everyone goes through me so I can see all the data. I can pull those passwords straight out of the streams. So I can get your passwords for remote desktop, for your mail, for stuff like that. So, and I can use that information later on. You know, internet banking will be a bit different because there's additional OTP and all that kind of stuff, you know, your one-time password, which is much harder. But your mail and stuff just flows across the network. So you can definitely pull that information out. So yeah, Andrew, don't go on public networks.
Yes, You it's see, not that I have anything to hide.
You've
it's
been asking me why I don't go onto public networks. That's my reason. I haven't really been able to articulate it, but that's my reason.
I really like free Wi-Fi. I really like free Wi-Fi, though. Let me ask you this, right? If I have my Gmail open already, right? And then I go on. So they can't. So I haven't accessed my password yet. Can they still pull it?
They'd pull your cookie. You're gonna make me go technical here, right? So essentially, with web, right?
Why are they pulling my cookie?
So they can penetrate you.
They're penetrating me on my cookie. I mean, ITs are sick fucks. Eh? Excuse my language. They really are. I mean, cookies, floppies, stiffies. You know, penetration. Okay, yeah. Tell me.
So essentially, when you log onto a website, the website needs to know who you are. So it gives you a cookie or a session cookie, and that cookie sits in your browser. And that every subsequent request you make to Gmail or anything passes that cookie across. And if I can grab that cookie, or if I can pull that out of the web requests, then I can put it into my browser, and then I look at you without logging on.
Oh, wow.
But I'd have to break the encryption, because remember, Gmail is behind HTTPS encryption. So you would get a very ugly message popping up on your screen saying your encryption's broken. It's best to say, leave that. You know, Google pops up a thing saying your encryption is broken. Mm. Proceed or no proceed. Don't proceed. Don't proceed.
So wait, okay, just before we hit the right to know guys, because they're going to talk a little bit about state surveillance. Tell me a little bit about how, you know, you spoke about keeping your data on a secure line, mm-hmm. but let's talk a little bit about things that we can do as just Rory and Andrew here, day-to-day activity. I'm going to go onto free Wi-Fi spaces. Mm-hmm. How do I keep my stuff safe?
Be vigilant. Like, as I said, that those Google warnings will come up on the Gmail stuff. You know, on Outlook, there will be warnings. And you just need to be vigilant that if you see those warnings, they'll pop up. There'll be messages that pop up and say, you know, a big red cross. And say, and if you click proceed, then you're pretty much taking your risk into your own hands when you do stuff like that.
Is it the same as like when they talk about an unsecured website? The lock at the top and they'll say...
The lock, that's the SSL encryption. So essentially what happens is if like for Gmail, if I want to get your cookie, I need to break that lock. So I need to essentially give you my own lock, but my unlock is not trusted by your computer. So it'll come up with a massive big red cross. Mm-hmm. But if you proceed, then you're accepting my encryption to me, so I can see all the data that's flowing between there. It's very complicated, Andrew. And
this is hectic, eh?
Yeah, but you know, it's all about the benefits. I'm going to sit at a public Wi-Fi as a hacker. What benefit am I going to get from that? You know, I'm going to sit there the whole day and try and get username and password for banking. But I still need your OTP anyway. So is there any massive benefit? I could be there for 6-7 days before I get anyone with banking details, and then I still need to break the OTP. So is it really worth it?
How important is your ID? I think that's the one interesting thing that you spoke about now. Like, if I get your ID details, am I good to go? Like,
well, ID document is definitely one of them. Like, as the banks get more secure, if they put in biometrics, all that kind of stuff to secure your identity within the banks, the next thing that's going to happen is the attackers are going to move to identity theft. Because it's all well and good. If you secure the banks fully, like with biometrics, PIN, you know, at the bank, at the ATM, you go to the ATM, put in your card, biometric swipe, you know, it'll be almost impossible to break that type of authentication. Then all they'll do is they'll just step back and they'll go to Home Affairs, which will be the next floor. And they'll get, you know, they'll clone your profile. And then they'll get a new bank card issued, or they'll get a... And that's the way it's going to go, unfortunately.
Seaton, let's move this from personal now to sort of national. We Anonymous has become quite famous, or let's say popular, for what they do. Let's call it, they like to look at themselves as the white knights of the internet and hacking. To what extent are armies now starting to have sort of social media or internet divisions to that, and what type of activities are we seeing them do? We heard of the hack, I think, of North Korea, of their nuclear facilities. Yeah. Yeah, the Stux thing. So it seems like this has become sort of another layer of warfare. How advanced is that? And in South Africa, how safe are we?
Well, from stage, I have no idea how far advanced our state institutions are. You know, we can only look at the information that's been released. And Stuxnet was a very, very good. I mean, that was a very, very advanced virus. That did all kinds of stuff. That was, and so much so that it would have cost a lot of money to produce that virus. So a lot of people think that it was actually state-sanctioned virus. It was a targeted state-sanctioned virus. But we don't know. It's conspiracy theories. But after looking at the code and the security research, it really does look that someone put a lot of time and money into that code. From our local guys, I'm actually not sure what their capabilities are. The NIA guys, I have absolutely no idea.
All right, let's bring in the Right to Know campaign guys. Spokesperson on the line from Cape Town, Murray Hunter, joins us now. Murray, good morning to you. You've been doing a lot of work, Right to Know, about state surveillance, about information that the government can hold. We saw your latest campaign around the idea of state surveillance and the state surveying all of us. What's that about?
Sure. Well, I think that when we talk about communication surveillance, we're talking about many different things, but it's useful to look at two specific concepts, and the one is targeted surveillance and the other is mass surveillance. So targeted surveillance is when you yourself are identified as a criminal or a troublemaker or a potential terrorist or whatever, and you are on a list and your communications is accepted. Mass surveillance is a more general system where lots of different people, potentially millions of people, entire sections of a population are subject to the same kind of general collection of their data. Now, when we look at like what Edward Snowden blew the whistle on in the U.S., and he was mainly exposing mass surveillance systems where general populations were having their vast amounts of their information collected online. In South Africa, we see hints that both of those things are happening. I mean, one of the things that people are paying increasing attention to in South Africa is the fact that journalists, whistleblowers, political activists, unionists, people who are kind of at the coalface of democracy are becoming increasingly concerned that their communications is not secure. This sounds like crazy man, conspiracy theory, tinfoil hat stuff. Yeah, but it's actually, I mean, this is a documented fact. We have two cases where investigative journalists had their phones tapped using Rika, which is a huge, obviously a huge violation of their personal privacy. It's a huge violation of media freedom. So that would be the Sunday Times investigative journalists. They had their phones tapped, and that's a documented fact. The Mail and Guardian journalists who were investigating the corruption case against Jacob Zuma before he became president, they had their phones tapped, and this has now also come out in court record. So these are documented facts. And this should be enough, really, for entire governments to topple, but, you know, that's not where we are as a country. That's fine. So that's where you see, in terms of targeted surveillance, those capabilities are being used and abused in ways that are kind of undemocratic. If you speak to any kind of political operator, whether they're members of parliament, whether they're maybe members of the ANC, these are people who are actually really worried that their phone conversations are not secure. They're worried that they're being spied on, in case they're sort of plotting against the president, in case they're seen as being unloyal to a certain faction. These are things, these folks are really worried about. So that's the targeted interception. But the other thing I wanted to talk about is mass surveillance, because in South Africa.
Before you get into mass surveillance, so some of the things that you've highlighted where there's targeted surveillance against people, we recently heard of the Helen Suzman Foundation robbery. Can you just tell us a little bit about what's that all about? Why is that so concerning? And just explain what happened there and why the Helen Suzman Foundation robbery is such an interesting part of the surveillance thing.
So people, the Helen Suzman Foundation is bringing all kinds of grief on the head of the Hawks, the Special Investigating Unit, and 3 days after they brought a court challenge to the appointment of the head of the Hawks, saying basically this person has been appointed to, I mean, this is not what they say, but if I could summarize it, they say that the head of the Hawks is effectively appointed in order to cover up major sensitive investigations of corruption. And so they challenged his appointment in court. And 3 days later, unidentified individuals raided their offices, took all their computers. And it was really one of those, I mean, some people say that it was an apartheid-style raid, but this is not something that is new to the democratic South Africa. It's very similar to what we saw when the Scorpions and police were at war with each other during the Celebi days in the 2000s. Now, those individuals have not been identified, but many people are putting two and two together to say, look, if it feels like the Hawks are one body that would have a particular interest in what's on the computers in the Helen Suzman Foundation. And what it suggests is a situation where a security structure, a very elite unit of the police, is targeting people who are seen as being threats to their legitimacy. Mm. People who are really, whatever you think of the Helen Suzman Foundation, people who are really doing what they believe is the right thing, and they're performing completely constitutional actions, things that are there to strengthen our democracy, and they're being targeted as a result. Mm. So in situations, I mean, that's not really about communication surveillance, but it's about the same system where people who are seen as being troublemakers appear to be coming under pressure, coming under threat. And it's that kind of visible, detectable abuse that may also be, that suggests that there's something maybe happening behind the scenes as well.
Marianne, just sticking with targeted surveillance for a bit. How then does the state protect us? Because it has to, obviously it has to suspect you first and then it has to investigate you. So if you've got nothing to hide, why is it a problem that there are that we're being snooped on and that government probably knows what's on my computer?
So firstly, everyone has something to hide. I'm fairly certain that there is something about your personal life that you wouldn't want to talk about right here on the radio. And I can guarantee
what is that, Rory?
That I got my stuff as well.
Yeah, Mary, what is that? Let's talk about that for a second, Mary. What is it that you don't want us to find? We've got a hacker here. We're going to just hack into your systems quickly.
The head of ANC Women's League said, we all have Smolanyana skeletons.
Yeah, we all have Smolanyana skeletons. and of course, that's the point, is that you know, the right to privacy is constitutionally protected because it says that we're all allowed to have our small and younger skeletons. And that might be financial information, it might be your medical information, it might be your love life. I have no right to that kind of information about you, even if you're not a good guy. No offense. But
I'm offended.
Yeah. So all of us have something to hide. That's the point. And I think a lot. I mean, I want to, when we start talking about mass surveillance, I think it's useful to talk about that because that's people's main concern. They say, well, look, I'm not a journalist. I'm not an activist. I'm not a political operator. I'm not someone who should feel vulnerable about these things.
So let's jump on mass surveillance. What is that and why is it such a big concern?
Well, you know, the thing is we all reek at our cell phones, right? Almost all of us, we should have recorded our cell phones, which is linked to your personal identity, to your number, to your SIM card, or, all of that stuff. And what people forget about Rika is that it requires your telecoms operator and your internet service provider to store your metadata for between 3 and 5 years.
So, Mary, just metadata for those of us that don't understand?
So metadata is not the content of the communication, but it's the information about the communication. So instead of being the content of the message, it might be the identity of who sent it and who received it, the time they sent it and received it, their location, the device they were using, so on and so forth. Mm. It might be the subject line of the email, for instance, but not the content. It would be your internet browser traffic and things like that. So people say, well, look, that's not the content of my communication. That's not the sensitive stuff. But actually, what we know from Snowden is that your metadata is actually very, very, very useful to people who are trying to build a profile of who you are, who you interact with, what you do, what your beliefs are, what your activities are, and also what your secrets are. They say, hey, look, you know, there's a very useful old expression which says that, you know, if people have access to your metadata, but not the content of the communications, they don't know your HIV status, but they do know you received a call from an HIV testing station, and you spent an hour on the phone with your doctor, and you spent an hour on the phone with your medical aide. They don't know the contents of that communication, but they can very much figure out what was in that call. So, look, that data is being stored for between 3 and 5 years for all of us. It means that that on the servers of MTN, Vodacom, Telecom, MWeb, whatever, there is these vast databases which actually profile the most intimate details of the lives of pretty much every South African who's tapped into a communication system of any kind. These are provisions that we haven't really ever thought about as South Africans. We haven't really had that moment that many other countries have had, sort of after Edward Snowden blew the whistle. There was, you know, these huge debates about privacy and these huge shifts, and we saw technological shifts, and we've seen that major technology companies have completely changed the way that they're doing things. Major governments have struck down laws, so on and so forth. In South Africa, this hasn't really happened, but in some ways, we're living under the same system.
I want to bring in Seton here just to talk about what you're talking about, mass surveillance. Seton, for me, the interesting thing about this whole thing is I'm getting freaked out right now, right? Just from what you said earlier and what Murray's saying on the line right now, it's starting to scare me a little bit. But at the same time, I'm just wondering how huge terrorist organizations can organize Brussels attacks and no one picks this stuff up. I mean, is it being picked up? How does that slip through the cracks? I mean, I'm sending, you know, like naked selfies to Rory here and that's getting picked up, but no one can pick up that a bomb is about to go off in Brussels airport.
The things that used to protect you could also be used to protect terrorists. For example, you've got encryption, you've got all this kind of stuff that you can use to protect you personally. Governments use it to protect their information, and terrorists can use the exact same means to communicate encrypted. WhatsApp calling is a primary example. It's encrypted now. All that metadata that Murray was talking about on the WhatsApp calling side, the service providers will have no access to that data. So, you know, you say, how does the surveillance miss all this stuff? It's because these people are technically smart. A lot of these terrorist organizations are technically smart, and they know how to use this organization. They use tools on the internet, anonymizing tools like Tor, etc., to do their browsing. And they'll use online calling services like WhatsApp, now that it's encrypted, or one of the other SIP calling services, which anonymize, and none of that metadata is stored. So we're allowing the state to do all of this monitoring of our metadata, etc., like that. But they say they want to do it to catch these terrorists, but the terrorists aren't using those systems. They're using additional encrypted systems. So, you know, I'm with Murray with this. Is that 5-year data? I think that sure it should be secured and it should be stored, but I think it should be court ordered to be able to access that information. I don't know if it is at the time, Murray. Is it?
That's the thing. It is court ordered. You basically. So let me just put on a different hat and act as a spokesperson and a defender of Rika, since someone has to, right? Rika, now all of us have linked our identities to our SIM cards using Rika. What Rika says is that no one can intercept your communication without a court order. Mm-hmm. They go through, there's a special Rika judge that police are supposed to go to in order to get a warrant, and then once they get that warrant, they must go to your communications provider, whether it's a network operator or an internet service provider, and they'll say, here's a court order for so-and-so for their data, give it to us. But we've seen situations that show that system is open to abuse. Now, those two cases I mentioned earlier, where investigative journalists had their phones tapped by the police at a time when they were investigating the police and prosecuting authorities for you know, major wrongdoing. They had their phones tapped using Rika. A judge signed a warrant for those journalists' communications to avail those communications. Now, in one case, what we saw is that the judge can be misled. What happens is what appears to have happened is that two rogue cops decided they wanted to tap the Sunday Times journalist's phones, and they simply slip their numbers into another affidavit to say, oh, we're investigating this chop shop in KZN. Here are the 8 numbers of people that we need to tap to try to investigate.
Oh, wow.
So that's pretty naughty. But in another case, at least one other case, we know that a judge knowingly signed off on a warrant to investigate a journalist where they said, oh, you know, yes, he's a journalist, but he's also up to some other dodgy stuff and we need to investigate. Clearly, that court order is not enough to protect people entirely. But when it comes to your metadata, so that's if those situations I just described is when we want to intercept the communications directly. I want to hear it as it happens. I want to get the messages as they come. But there's also, remember that all of that data about you is stored for up to 5 years. If it's older than 90 days, I don't have to go to a RICO judge, a specialist judge. I can go to any magistrate and get that warrant. And the thing that is scary about that is that there are magistrates across the country who presumably are signing these warrants, and no one in the country can tell you how often they're doing it, how many requests they get, how many they accept, how many they turn down, because no one is monitoring it. The Department of Justice cannot give you that information.
Wow.
No one can give you that information, I can tell you, because we've been trying for several years to find out. But we're also that's already a problem. But we're also seeing signs that this data might be, because once it's been stored, this data might be vulnerable to people accessing it without without a court order. Mm. We see reports that, you know, in the Mail and Guardian last year, that a cop or, you know, even basically law enforcement can go to members of the telecoms providers and just kind of cage the data off of them, just like sort of, you know, charm it out of them without a court order. So that's already a problem. We see signs that the South African government itself has the ability to intercept signals without going to the telecoms providers. So basically getting around the RICO system and getting around your MTNs and your Vodacoms and getting access to those signals themselves. So we don't really know enough, but we do know that basically your data is not as secure as it should be. And that raises the question about whether we should be storing that metadata at all. Sorry, going back like 5 minutes to what you just said, should we be storing that data at all? There's an argument to be said that you should only start storing the data once someone is suspected of a crime.
Yeah.
So you get a court order. What we have right now is that everyone has been having their information collected, whether they're suspected of doing anything wrong or not. Everyone in the country. Maybe it should be that if I want to collect your data, I must first get a court order for it to be stored, to say this person is potentially up to something suspicious. Let's start storing his information and going through it and see if we can, you know, if we have a case.
Guys, just bringing it back to personal, we are now in the age of the Internet of Things, and we're putting all sorts of things on our bodies and so on. Does that obviously then increase the risk that eventually you are going to be hacked as a person? Your body is going to be hacked. Like, how far are we from that?
Well, I know some of the guys, even locally here, the MWR guys and some of the other guys, have hacked a few cars already. So, you know,
A few cars.
Well, they hacked the cars via the I think it was the SD card in one of the cars, getting the ABS to lock up, etc.
Wow.
So, but it's not a remote hack; it was locally. But so, you know, as we move into an environment where everything is interconnected, you know, your Fitbit connects to your phone and connects across to the internet, so I can pretty much know how many steps you've taken, you know, that day.
That's big information.
well, you know, maybe this is useful for people who wear those kind of Apple watches and other smart watches. And there was a paper recently that suggested that if you wear the watch on your dominant hand, that there's a very high probability that someone who hacks the watch can figure out what your ATM pin code is because of the geometric, you know, because it can figure out, well, he's moving.
Oh, my word. Wow. So basically, now when I go to an ATM, I need to get naked, basically. Take all my clothes off and then start with the transaction. Is that what you're saying, Murray?
That is exactly what I'm saying.
Murray, aren't you concerned about your personal safety and in terms of hacking? I mean, you're the spokesperson for Right to Know campaign. Surely, I mean, this conversation is being recorded right now.
Well, yeah, we're on the radio, right? This conversation is being recorded.
Oh, that's a good point. We are recording this. Wow, technology is so intense. Well, this technology is intense, eh?
You have to get up pretty early in the morning to trick me like that. But, look, I think that everyone should exercise reasonable caution. These are, you know, the, as I just said, the point about these systems is that actually some people may be more vulnerable than others, but we're all potentially opted into the system that does make us vulnerable. So you need to exercise caution. I mean, we see that the fears of surveillance are becoming more and more of a feature of activist organizations like the Right to Know and civil society organizations like the Helen Suzman Foundation. What you find is that when it comes to grassroots community organizations that Right to Know is working with, who are often involved in service delivery protests, they're often involved in very basic local government accountability questions, poor people's movements, those fears have been alive for a lot longer, going back years and years, these fears about surveillance. So these are a feature of our lives, and you see that journalists as well are having these fears. And the truth is that There are two possible options when you're worried about your communications and you're worried about surveillance. And the one is to close up completely. You go underground, you hide under a rock, because that's a very easy that's a very easy response. And that's one of the reasons surveillance is such a threat. It's not just a threat to your privacy, but it's also a threat to your freedom of expression, because people who feel like they're being watched feel less comfortable
expressing
themselves
stuff, yeah,
in a way that's open. But the I think that that's a very dangerous response at the same time, because the truth is that if you feel like you're being watched, the first thing to do is to conduct yourself as if you're always being watched. We have the conversation I'm having now with the, with you on the radio is a conversation that I would feel comfortable having with anyone in any circumstances, because I just we must always assume that nothing is entirely secret. But there are also things that we can do to protect ourselves more. You can start encrypting. Yesterday, WhatsApp finally unveiled its complete end-to-end encryption across all platforms, which is greatly, greatly increases the security of your WhatsApp communication system. I'm assuming that we've already discussed that. You can protect your devices. You can use Tor to protect your internet browser traffic if you want. But you know, ultimately, you have to carry on doing the things that you do, and you can't let this stuff shut you down.
Murray, we're running out of time. How do you protect yourself? So we've asked Seton. So as an individual, you know, who's not very tech savvy, how do you, as an individual, protect yourself?
Well, everyone has their secrets, right?
yes, this guy's dodgy.
This man works for Right to Know. This man works for Right to Know.
No, look, one of the things that is great is, as I said, the kind of secure communications that we all want has often been very difficult to come by. That real security is often extremely inconvenient. But as I said, one of the great things is that WhatsApp yesterday unveiled that it has finally implemented this end-to-end encryption, which means basically all messages and calls between people who have the most up-to-date version of WhatsApp are exchanging messages that are encrypted on one phone and only decrypted when it gets to the other phone. It means that even WhatsApp if they intercept your communications, they can't actually read the messages, which adds a huge layer of extra security to people's communications. But doesn't come at any major inconvenience. It's not a perfect tool, but it's a really great tool because it's easy to use. You don't have to be a genius to use it. Everyone is already using WhatsApp. It means that 1 billion people in the world, approximately, are now woke up this morning with potentially better security than they had yesterday.
Gents, very quickly, we have to wrap up, but there's also security at work. What's the story there? Can your boss actually read the company you work for? Are they allowed to read your emails? Are they allowed to see what you do on your work computer? How does that work? Because I know it's not as simple as, oh, you signed a contract, therefore we can look at your emails.
My view is that people should get their email retention policy. Find out if your business has an email retention policy, because what you'll often find is that businesses do. You may or may not know it, but you signed away your right to, if you're using an office email, if you're using a business email, you may have signed away the right to that private communication, which means possibly you should use your private email if you're sending private email.
But if I'm logging into Gmail using my work computer and it's my private Gmail, is that protected?
Maybe the technical experts will have to answer that one, but you should be covered.
You should be covered 100%. As long as you've got that little lock and it's going through and you don't have any issues with it, then you should be 100% fine.
Okay, so that's a lock in my web browser.
Yeah, lock in the web browser, and as long as you got that, then you're 90% secure that your personal email is going through securely.
All right, Andrew Levy, let's land this thing.
Murray, thank you so much for joining us on the phone. It's Right to Know campaign spokesperson Murray Hunter joining us from Cape Town. Thank you so much, and good luck with all your endeavors going forward.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Let's close this out. I'm pretty much freaked out right now. I won't be sending you any more goat porn. me and a goat and, via anything, because I'm stressed about
that. The reason
why
they haven't hacked us is that I haven't started sending you naked pics.
Yeah, it's true. They don't care about me too much.
Yeah, it's like,
But the interesting thing that I was just thinking about now when we're talking is that we are on radio and there's all this new voice encryption stuff. They could just record our voices, very easily done, and then just rechange words, letters, and so on, and then they'll hack you.
Imagine that. We're going into a world where just speaking is a big risk all on its own. And I saw the other day your iPhone specifically has this fingerprint thing. they've figured out how to basically create a copy of your fingerprint and basically break into it.
You saw that the other day. What's wrong with you? That was like 2 years ago.
Anyway, let's get out of here.
See you today. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio today. Where can people find out information if they want to get hold of you to protect themselves? Where would they go? Nowhere, absolutely
yeah,
nowhere.
Exactly. Privacy guy, dude. Come on.
I'm off the net. I'm
all right, he's out of here. He's off the radar. What can we do? Okay, fair enough. Thank you so much for joining us. You can check out the podcast, cliffcentral.com/frankly speaking. How safe are your privates? Yo, hectic. Ciao, ciao. Have a good day.
This is cliffcentral.com.